Here with Ken Aletta, who is most recently the author of Googled. Ken, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I wanted to first start with one of your basic theses in this book. Terry Winograd told you that Page and Brin's clear, coherent view comes from an engineering point of view, and you have made the distinction in numerous interviews that Brin and Page are, in fact, cold engineers rather than cold businessmen. First off, I'm curious, what is wrong with an engineering point of view in running a company? And second, I'm wondering why you believe Page and Brin to be cold. Thirdly, is this possibly, as Nicholson Baker suggested in his New York Times book review, that this came from your aversion, their aversion to you interviewing them? Or?
To take the last point last, Baker's review was a positive review, but just got it totally wrong. I could not have done this book without Google's cooperation. There was no aversion. I mean, they cooperated. I was on their campus. I interviewed everyone I wanted to interview, which I could not have done without their cooperation. So I was pleased with the cooperation I got from Google. To go back to the other two points, they're cold engineers because what an engineer does is look at how to make something more efficient. And they ask, why not? They ask these provocative questions. Why can't we digitize all the books in the world? Why does advertising have to be so wasteful? Why can't you have cheaper or even free phone calls? Why can't you have cloud computing instead of expensive, you know, software packages from Microsoft? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the process of asking those questions, inevitably, you are going to disrupt existing traditional media businesses. And their attitude is it's about efficiency. It is not about copyright, which is something that traditional media concerns about. It is less about privacy than other people would worry about. And it's not about the size of Google, because we don't think we have monopoly. We think people can just click off us in a second, unlike escaping Microsoft 10 years ago when they had 95% of all the operating systems. So, but it's cold in the sense that it's about making things more efficient. And for instance, if we were talking about a green eyeshade type who ran finances for a major media company, and we said all these he or she is interested in his cost cutting, we would say they're cold, right? Engineers are cold in the sense they're looking at efficiencies. They're not looking at the after effects of those efficiencies.
This leads me to ask you two questions. First of all, why does making things efficient translate into coldness? And second of all, what's wrong with some of these untraditional views?
It's fabulous. Are you kidding? I think the book is, where Baker got it wrong is this book is praise of, thank you, of the efficiencies that Google brings about. I mean, if you think about it, a newspaper to kill all those trees and make expensive paper and invest in expensive printing plants and then to have a distribution system of trucks belching environmental pollution into the air, which is wildly expensive, how much more efficient is it to read a newspaper online?
Yeah.
It's fabulous, I mean, to be able to do that. The problem is, and where the cold comes in, is how do you preserve what good journalism in an online world? That's a basic question. I'm not saying you can't, but it is a basic question. And the engineer asks the first question, how do I make it more efficient? They tend not to ask the second question, which is, how do I preserve good journalism?
But don't such questions get settled out when an initiative is laid down? I mean, for example, look at Talking Points Memo. Broke the U.S. attorney scandal. Does a lot of great journalism. I mean, journalism certainly is translatable to online, and maybe this is just a scenario that's going to play out in the next 5 years.
Maybe, and I'm open to that totally. On the other hand, I there are certain things as a journalist, you know, that I want to preserve, and one of them is good journalism. And good journalism is not, as some people on the web proclaim, good journalism is not necessarily just an individual and whoever, let 1,000 flowers bloom and they will come out. Good journalism is also composed of an organization that supports the journalist, with good editors and copy editors and fact checkers and people who are challenging that reporter, or maybe giving that reporter the luxury of a couple months to do an investigative piece that an individual alone doesn't have time to do and doesn't have the credibility to go interview or the credential to go interview people. New York Times, for instance, a couple of weeks ago ran a front page story that the reporter had been working on for several months about the infrastructure of our sewage system in the United States. Now, some people might find that boring. It basically said that much of it is 100 years or more old, and it's falling apart, and politicians don't want to invest because there's no glamour and no returns to get reelected.
Well, there are returns in a different sense, but
yeah. Yeah, right. And so that's the kind of journalism that the New York Times did. An individual can't replicate that alone. When I go out and do a story for the New Yorker, I am being challenged all the time by my editors. And when I hand in the piece and they say to me, Ken, I think you buried your lead. Your real lead is on page 13. They're trying to make my work better, and they are making it better. But that's a team. It's a collaborative effort. So team is real important to good journalism. It's not exclusively important, but it's important.
We have two issues we have to unpack here. The first one being, well, I could also cite a good and a bad thing with the New York Times this Sunday. The good thing was this really amazing audio slideshow the New York Times did of people who were trying to get a job at Applebee's. There were 6,500 jobs, and there were only 120 people actually managed to get in. That, to me, is an important story. This was countered by an extremely gratuitous, flaky, long 7,000-word story on how difficult it is to be married that ran in the New York Times magazine.
I couldn't read it.
Yeah.
I saw the headline. I don't want to read it.
Yeah, but the suggestion here is that the New York Times, just like any blog, any website, is unfortunately susceptible to these market influences. Does the coldness that you're essentially pointing to, is this a result of not considering, I suppose, the impact of either an organizational front or this perpetuation of something perhaps coming from an online influence, or perhaps that was always there all along? Because the New York Times style section, as we know, keeps a lot of freelancers in business writing a lot of trivial things, you know?
A lot, and the New York Times is certainly, I'm not extolling it as a perfect institution. I do think it's the best newspaper in the world. I'm not criticizing the coal engineer. The engineers at Google are doing their job, and they're doing it brilliantly. And they have produced wondrous things for us that I sit back and I'm awed by, okay? I mean, I start from that assumption. And I also start from the assumption or conclusion that the traditional media that has been disrupted by Google and the internet and the digital world have themselves mostly to blame. Not exclusively, but mostly themselves. They could have been much more proactive. They could have invested in the digital world. They could have stopped moaning and whining about, well, what Google is doing to me. Oh, woe is me. And get off their ass and do some creative things, and they didn't.
They could have followed Lincoln's advice: keep your enemies close and your friends, or keep your friends close and your enemies close.
Yeah.
Hiring all these, like the top technorati 500 bloggers onto newspapers, and then that would have perhaps created the drift of audience. You think?
Or say that we're going to create an online newspaper, which many of them, they would come back to me as I'm reporting this book, and they would say to me, "Well, you know, we had an online newspaper a dozen years ago," and I would come back at them. I said, "Yeah, but what was that online newspaper? The online editor reported to the editor of the old newspaper. The online editor was told you cannot break news until it appears in the newspaper the next morning. So it wasn't real time, which the digital world allows. It was the old time of the existing newspaper, which was insane. And it wasn't, they weren't generally, the people put in charge of these online newspapers were people from the print newspaper who didn't, in most cases, understand that the internet is a different medium.
Yeah.
It's a multimedia thing, and it's two-way. And the top-down command structure of a traditional newspaper didn't get it. And that's one of the reasons why their online newspapers are playing catch-up.
I'll get back to Google in a moment, but while we're on the subject of newspapers, I have two questions in relation to that. One, did you see the latest McSweeney's, which actually is a full-scale newspaper where they hired writers like Andrew Sean Greer, William Volman, Daniel Handler, numerous people who were actually paid to do a one-shot of a newspaper in San Francisco and printed in very glorious type. Do you think that the problem is one of two things? the hierarchy that is in a print newspaper needs to merge with, I suppose, the creative liberation that comes with online, that this is the solution. I mean, my theory is that the minute that the New York Times starts allowing the use of the word fuck, that might actually open up a few doors in terms of expression. What are your thoughts on this? And how, maybe tying it back to Google, how does Google come into play with all
this? I think if I were running a traditional media company, let's say a newspaper, and fortunately I don't and wouldn't want to, and I have the luxury of having opinions, but I'm not responsible for anything. I'm a journalist, and that's comforting. But if I were, what I would do is I would first of all hire an engineer who I trusted to be at my elbow to help me navigate this world, since I'm not an engineer. Second, I would start with a bias, and the bias is I'm going to lean forward. I want to know what I can do to be proactive. I don't want to lean back. I don't want to be defensive. I don't want to say, how do I defend my fort from this digital onslaught? I want to say, how do I ride that digital wave? How do I become a part of it? And becoming a part of it is, as your question points out, you know, what do I do that makes me relevant in a new world where people get their information in different ways, view newspapers in a different way, maybe don't even read a newspaper, maybe read what their friends send to them on or tweet them or Facebook, and that's a world I want to be part of, and if I'm not, I'm doomed.
So you're saying, going back to Google, that the so-called cold engineer, or the engineer who perhaps is warmer by way of considering such questions, is the person who you would like to see, rather than some adjunct figure like Coach Campbell or Schmidt, in this case. I mean, it is a very curious scenario within Google, because you have a triumvirate, essentially, and you have this kind of Coach Campbell figure who comes in and rallies the troops and gives them warm fuzzies and all the like. But on the other hand, it is a very interesting way to run a company, and it does create a certain kind of culture that has created what has become a considerable revolution. And I'm wondering if Brin and Page have essentially made up for their socially inept limitations by considering Schmidt and Coach Campbell the like. Do you think it's a?
I think Schmidt, who's two decades older, as a CEO, brings a certain experience that Sergey and Larry miss. Campbell, who's a decade older than Schmidt, brings another dimension of experience. But all of them are out of the digital world, essentially. Campbell was once in advertising, but he's been out there and part of that world. They are not as sensitive, and by their own admission, they're not. They admit this to me in the book. They were not as sensitive to, say, the book publishing industry when they said, well, let's just digitize. They weren't as aware as they should have been of copyright and why that might be a concern, which is why they were sued. Now they've settled it. And it's still in the courts, and the Justice Department has to weigh in, and they've got problems with governments all over the world on this, on so many different issues, including privacy. So Google, as they said to me, we are not sensitive. We lack, as Sergey Brin said to me when I asked him about it, he said, we lack a certain emotional intelligence here. That's what I mean by cold engineer. We're talking about rounded people. We're just talking about someone who has a broad view. Eric Schmidt is a PhD and an engineer. He would also be the first to acknowledge to you, as he did to me, that, you know, I lack certain experiences in the world, and we're learning as we go along. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that what they're doing is wrong. I mean, I think what to digitize all the world's books, my God, it's awesome. I mean, it's fabulous to bring books that are out of print back in print, to help someone discover an author that maybe should be rediscovered. I mean, it's unbelievable. To have at my fingertips all the world's books the way I have at my fingertips search, my God, I get chills just thinking about how great that is. I got a library in my home. Without having to move, I got a library. And it's all Google's fault.
On the other hand, there are very interesting scenarios, like the anecdote that Al Gore relayed to you, in which he went and expressed some concerns to Brin and Page over search threats. They called in 10 managers into the room. Next thing you know, Al Gore comes down 4 weeks later, and all 10 engineers are there actually ensconced, working removing the toys in Brennan Page's private office. And as he says, I defy you to think of any other executives in the world who would have a team like that into their personal office for weeks on end. Creative thinking. Creative, possibly eccentric approach. But really, does this account... I mean, I guess I'm wondering if this possibly atones for the distinction that you make.
Yeah.
Is it okay?
Yeah, I mean, this is... My hope is that I've written a complicated book. And any time you look closely at something and experience something for a long period of time, if you're an independent journalist, I'm not a flack for Google, right? But I'm also not a partisan. I'm not anti-Google. I'm not here representing old media and trying to trounce Google. I mean, I came away as an independent journalist with a sense of awe and I kept on asking the question, where did two young guys get such clarity of thinking to know we're not going to create a portal, we're not going to try and trap people in the Google site, we're going to send them to where they want to go, we're not going to have ads on that opening page, we're going to not milk the advertiser for as much as we can, we're only going to charge them when someone clicks on the ad, and then with the Vickery auction, we're only going to charge them a penny more than the second highest bidder. So how did they know to do those things? How do they know to create two classes of stock and say we're going to control it because we want to make long-term decisions in the interest of long-term investment and growth of Google? And how is it that two young guys retained since 98 the passion they had in 98 and the passion that says when Al Gore comes in and says, my God, I'm worried, are we doing as much as we should in search? And he meets with this team, and then he reports to Sergey and Larry, and they say, "You're right. We're going to pull them in our office. We're going to disrupt our lives because we're not going to let them escape until we analyze whether we've done everything we can." That's passion, and that passion is palpable when you go out there. When I go out there and I sat in the engineering meetings with these guys, again, the thought that Larry and Sergey didn't cooperate with me, I'm sitting in their engineering meetings. I'm watching them. And what I saw and I describe in the book is these guys are never satisfied. The engineers would come in and say to them, you know, well, we didn't make the optimum suggestion here because it would cost too much and it might take too long. And then they impatiently say, don't give us that. We empower you to tell us what the best solution is, not the cheapest or the quickest. And that sense of perfection of and that passion to achieve perfection is palpable at Google. And it comes from these two guys in part. And it has to infect everyone else in the organization.
I have a question, actually. Gmail, when it was first introduced, it didn't have a delete key, as you point out in the book. A button was eventually added. When Google introduced its browser, Google Chrome, there was a huge outcry online saying, what are you doing putting this clause in the EULA? Essentially, we give up our privacy, we give up our right to essentially be private because of this clause which grants an unknown assigns all these rights. But in both cases, and in the Chrome, they quickly reversed that decision, removed the clause. The question is should we be concerned that Google might shift its emphasis from the user, which was there from the very beginning, faster, smarter search results, to that of the advertiser? It would seem to me, based off of the history so far, Google has, to the extent that it can, respected the right to privacy, at least in this sense.
Yes, I think Google to date has kept its focus on the user, and it's one of the reasons for their success. I think people trust them, and every measurement of every Fortune year-end piece or whatever, or Forbes, is always saying Google is among the most trusted companies in the world, and that's partly because they work at it. And part of the reason for their success is user trust. The danger is, what I'm saying is that they have not violated that trust. There is a danger they might, because they have so much data on us. And as their search business slows, and if they don't figure out how to monetize YouTube or Android or cloud computing, which are the three horses they're betting on for future growth engines. If they don't, and search is slowing, more pressure will be exerted on them from advertisers to get more information. Yeah. To learn more about Google's users in order to better target their ads and pay a higher price. Google will then have to make that choice. So while I trust Google, I don't trust anyone who has power. Totally. I don't say you have a blank check if you have power. I don't trust big corporations. I don't trust big government. I don't trust big anyone who has that kind of power. I mean, that's our job, to be sure there are checks and balances. And that's part of what a government referee is supposed to do.
Yeah.
Not participate in the game, but blow the whistle if there's an infraction. So you worry about it.
But on the other hand, let's look at Google Book Search. They have managed to get all sorts of orphaned and out-of-print books available in a manner that may not have been available. I mean, some title that only exists in the Library of Congress is now in Google Book Search. So given the choice between Google having a monopoly on this or that book not existing at all, yes, it's kind of, I agree with you and I share your anti-authoritarian concerns, but on the other hand, a part of me says, well, it would be nice to have that book available. And nobody's claiming the rights to it. It's an orphan title. So it becomes a very interesting moral dilemma. Which would you choose? I'm curious.
It's not a moral dilemma in the sense that I want Google Books to be done. And I want those orphan books available electronically and those out-of-print books available electronically. And I want them available for searches as well as for purchase. Or for libraries. I mean, that's a no-brainer for me. I mean, it's a great good. But there are protections you can build in at the same time to assure that if some other company wants access to this, that they can get access to these books, so that there might be other people who want to publish the same book and maybe want to create a competitive pricing situation against Google. And they pay. It's the same argument you have about telephone lines.
Yeah.
I mean, or cable lines. Are they going to be open? That's one question. You want some question of what's going to be done with the privacy issues. I mean, because you're collecting the book search, you're collecting a mountain of data,
yeah.
More data. Third issue is, what about the pricing? Now it's free for libraries and it's a minimum price for schools, right? And Google Books, that's what the proposed settlement is. What if Google wants to jack up the price for libraries and schools? Because if they're a monopoly, you can do that. Those are legitimate concerns for government and for the referee, in my judgment. But don't stop it, my God. That would be terrible.
Yeah. But is this necessarily Google's fault? I mean, here we have a situation, we have an increasingly privatized world that we live in which public services are then outsourced. I mean, the CIA, for example, 70% of their sources, I learned, you know, not long ago, are outsourced. It's shocking. And the question is whether Google should be entirely penalized for doing something of their own money and providing something at a relatively affordable price, which, you know, in an ideal world, I would love to see the government do this.
How are they being penalized?
Well, I mean, the question is again, this notion of a monopoly being there or nothing being there. Is it Google's fault, or is it inevitably the byproduct of our increasingly privatized world?
No, but the if you look at Google Book, the publishers, Association of Publishers,
yep.
And the Authors Guild have agreed to a settlement with Google.
Yes.
Google has agreed to pay them $125 million. And for rights, you know, for authors, and willingly done that, and the publishers have agreed that Google should be able to do this, and this is a really good thing for books and for authors, so they're in agreement now. Then the government, the people come in, and libraries and other groups come in and express concerns. The government, the court, Judge Chin is the federal court judge, is looking at it. He's weighing whatever the agenda the Justice Department weighs in with. And in February, there'll be a hearing, and he probably will issue a ruling. Google has already acknowledged that we'll make some further amendments to its plan. But in the end, Google and the publishers and the Authors Guild are on the same page. They're in agreement,
yeah.
Moving forward. So they're just eyeing out some wrinkles to try and deal with some of the concerns I've talked about, privacy, monopoly, which are legitimate things. And, you know, for government to be asking. And Google is basically saying, yeah, we have to broaden our thinking, and we're doing that in cooperation with the publishers and the authors. I think we're going to have it.
In relation to Google Book Search as well, I'm curious if the threat to authors' livelihood has possibly been overstated. I mean, when you find a book through Google Book Search, you get a limited view, if it's available at all. And authors, of course, if they were lucky enough to go ahead and raise their complaints by the deadline, were allowed to not have anything except for the snippet view online. Now, this to me, yes, there's the monopoly concern, but on the other hand, if you see something online and it's only a limited view, then one is inspired to actually grab the real book, as opposed to, you know, it's almost an encouragement. It's almost like a carrot here. So I'm curious.
It is, but then you got to look at books. If my book is a cookbook, and you can take 20% of it, right, which is Google's definition of fair use in this case. Well, if you can get pluck from that key recipes from my book, you don't have to buy my book. So you've harmed me as a cookbook author, yeah. I would argue, right? Yeah. That's a legitimate concern. If I have a book that is about, I'm blocking the guy's name, but who writes about how things work in the world, he writes these wonderful books. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think.
I mean, his books that basically have pregnant paragraphs that are really important. If I can pluck those paragraphs, I don't have to buy his book. I can do a search. So there are legitimate concerns. If you take 20% of one of my book, if it's only 20% you can get, but if you can go each day and get a different 20%, that might be of concern to me too, right? Okay.
But that would be an exceptionally patient reader. I mean, for me, it's quite, if you're talking about immediate gratification, I'm going to go to the bookstore or the library.
I opted in. I want my books to be searched. I want them to hopefully get more traffic. That's great. On the other hand, when Sergey Brin, I tell this story in my book, when Sergey Brin says to me, comes into our second interview of three, and he says, Ken, let me ask you a question. He said, why don't you just publish this book for free online? You get many more readers. And I said, well, that's an interesting point, Sergey. And again, this is fresh thinking, out of the box thinking. And I say, who would pay me? I'm on leave from the New Yorker now to write this book. And I have to, my advance is what I'm living on. Who would pay me the advance? Would you ask a plumber to work for free? I mean, why should a writer work for free, A? Well, he says, well, it's a long term. I say, all right, long term. Who's going to edit my book? Who's going to do the index for my book? Who's going to send me on a book promotion tour? Who's going to pay my expenses to come out here 13 times, which I did? You know, airplane, hotel, meals. I mean, who's going to do it? And, of course, at that point, he's mum. He didn't have an answer. And there is not a good answer to that, I think, right now. So I'm not about to say I'm going to give up my livelihood on a bet that I'll figure out some way to monetize online. I can't afford to do that.
There's one question that is presented in the book but never actually quite answered, and it's probably something I just observed. That is Google's fixation with the number 150. They have 150 projects. They have cafeterias and conference rooms that are max 150. Did you ever get an answer as to why they were obsessed with this number? Numerologists?
I don't think they're obsessed about the 150 products. In fact, I think now they're probably below 150 products. The 150, Larry actually did a search. Larry is fixated on 150 as the size of cafeterias, to have people collaborate and talk to each other and not be hold back and not talk to each, you know, engage. And he did a Google search and came up with that answer to confirm his instinct. Now, have I done that search to check that he's? No, I have not. But he, in his scientific way, you know, came up with that answer, and he goes around the cafeterias and he'll say, this is too big, this is the right size.
Yeah.
And it's, each of them have little fetishes and that they're passionate about and they're insistent on. And that's one of Larry Page's. And who's to say he's wrong? I mean, they've done pretty good.
Let's go back to the three horses you were talking about earlier. Google is developing, well, anywhere from 150 products to less, as we've just established. Search revenue is starting to dwindle. I'm curious if some of the more recent products, like, for example, Chrome OS, which is an open source scenario, and Google Wave, these are a little bit different from the norm because it's almost, the learning curve is a little bit more. It's something that's more designed for geeks than for regular people. Do you see this as a sort of way of them possibly either A, anticipating that more regular people, more lay people will become power users, or are they just essentially basically carrying on with the same instinct that drove their company in the first place, which was, let's go ahead and do this and the revenue will come later?
It's everything's a jump ball. Everything is, let's experiment, let's try this. And that's part of the genius of Google and the genius of the two founders. Their willingness to try things, to basically ask uncomfortable questions. And the why question, why not? They come in every meeting and they say, why not? And so why not do Chrome? Why not do Wave? Why not have, you know, cloud computing? We have this computer capacity. Why don't we utilize it? And why do people have to spend $300-some-odd for Microsoft package software? Why not have it in the cloud, which will follow you wherever you go on any device you're on? So they're asking those questions and they're trying those things. And I think it's much more the latter point. It's basically, let's take some risk. We have the resources to do it.
Yeah.
And wouldn't this really be cool?
Or maybe it's just a natural expansion. I mean, for some reason, reading your book, I was struck very much by the history of iTech in the 60s. You know, iTech, where they were the people behind Project Corona, and they just gobbled up companies left and right, similar to what Microsoft did through three decades later. But Google is a little bit different in the sense that everything is essentially developed in-house. Does this essentially ensure that they won't implode like iTech? And to some degree, Microsoft has seen a considerable siphoning off, and well, now they've got Windows 7 and the like, and that's helping stay afloat. But,
you know,
but for a while, it's touching.
But Google buys. They bought Android.
Yeah.
They didn't invent that. They bought it and took the guy who invented it, and he's there running their, you know, running Android for them, mobile device business. They are one of the dangers they have, and for instance, they don't have a social networking gene.
Yeah.
So they've been slow in that area. Though you noticed yesterday what they did, they announced search will extend to social networks in real time. And it's a weakness they have. And it's a weakness of any company if you rely just internally. It could be a weakness if you just go out and acquire, in effect outsourcing everything. They're trying to do both. Will they succeed? I don't know. No one knows. I mean, it's the game continues and there's no end in sight. But at some point we'll find out. Other great companies failed and then came back. Apple failed and then came back.
Yeah.
So, you know, I take a long view of this stuff. But they are trying things, but they're getting large. And as you get large, you start losing creative people, or you lose people who say, I want to go to a startup and make a killing because I joined this company after people had already made their killing in the 2004 IPO. So Google is challenged, like any big, successful company is challenged, to stay on top and to stay creative. And do we invent it or do we buy it is a basic question any company faces.
Some arguments against cloud computing are, for example, the minor outages that YouTube and Gmail experienced. On the other hand, isn't this the risk of any technology? I mean, the power could go out right now, or, for example, cell phone networks. We've all experienced that.
I'll give you a great example. Two computers have crashed on me in the last month and a half. My first was a Dell desktop, and it crashed. I'm working on a New Yorker piece, right?
Yeah.
I'm working on a speech about Google, right, for my book tour. And I can't get it out of my, how do I get it out of my hard drive? I need someone to come in and get that out. That's going to take a little time to do, right? But I have a laptop. I put my laptop on my desk. I save documents I'm working on something called Dropbox, which is basically cloud computing,
yeah.
Right? So I was able, my work was not disrupted because I had Dropbox. I had cloud computing. I then had, last Saturday, my new desktop crashed, right? A fan problem, right?
Was it a Dell?
No, it's a Sony Vaio with a new 24-inch.
You build your own machines.
It's insane. And with Microsoft 7, with, you know, but it's like an iMac, no box. I mean, it's all built in. It's a really cool, it's black, it's a great, I mean, and after, I have it for 2 weeks, it crashes, right? I had the same issue, but I was on Dropbox.
Yeah.
So cloud computing really worked for me. On the other hand, if you get the outages, which you've had several times with Gmail, which I'm on, or you had with YouTube when you had an incident in Thailand, a crash, the world became worldwide, then you're off. You know, I lose control. So I find myself torn. I like control, I want to control. On the other hand, Dropbox saved my life.
Uh-huh. So this is a subjective scenario. Like when Twitter goes out, everybody freaks out, and I'm like, oh, good, I can actually get some work done. You know? I mean, if you're talking about control, I mean, if the technology is 99.9% effective, I'm wondering if such criticisms are, I mean, we expect things to screw up from time to time. Nobody's perfect. No infrastructure is perfect.
Ooh, my computer crashed.
Yeah.
And in the old way of doing things with package software, and I was dead, except for cloud computing.
Got it. Oh, I actually wanted to address Eric Schmidt's piece recently in the Wall Street Journal.
On newspapers?
Yes, on newspapers. He basically talked about promotional value being the key thing that Google would offer to news services. But I'm curious if about this notion of promotional value, whether it's even a tenable variable with regard to newspapers. I mean, is Google that powerful? Newspapers cannot possibly, even with Rupert Murdoch's present experiments, that you have to be on Google or nothing? There's no way to combat this?
I think what... I there is promotional value in search or Google News or Yahoo News or whatever. I mean, for a newspaper, there's no question. And if it takes someone to your website and you have a chance to sell ads off it, or more people are reading, that allows you to have a higher charge more for the ads on your online edition. No question about that. And more people are reading, and your brand value might increase them. On the other hand, if it commoditizes your newspaper, where people, when they do a search or go to Google News, don't really notice that it's the Wall Street Journal they're reading or the New York Times. They write Afghanistan ? And they get whatever, and they click on whatever they do, and they don't even pay attention to the source of that news. You have diminished the value of that brand and commoditized it, and that's the danger. So when Murdoch, and joined by a phalanx of newspapers behind him, say, I want to negotiate a deal with Bing, Microsoft.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to charge. I think he's doing a smart thing. I think he's creating a competitive situation where Google has to try and respond to. Google does want to have a world where they don't have the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post on that page, or the AP. I mean, that would harm search. And so traditional media is trying to, it's an opening shot in a negotiation that will go on. And what they're going to try and do is get from Google what Google gave publishers, $125 million. They're starting to pay for content on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that's a reasonable thing for content creators to be asking for. But Google is not going to pay for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Chicago Tribune and broadcast stations around the world. I mean, it's insane. They will have to fend that off, because there's going to be a long line of people with their hats out, you know, put money in Mr. Google, and they won't do it. But I think that's a legitimate thing to be going through now. And to strengthen Bing is a useful thing. I want search competitors. I mean, it's a fabulous thing to have competition.
On the other hand, if the strategy of various companies, whether it be Murdoch or a television network, is to get people onto their sites, I'm wondering if that doesn't account for just the reality of the way that we now sift through information. I mean, you point to CBS in this book being the first television network to actually have a YouTube channel. They're doing actually quite well in the ratings. In fact, when Letterman had his little blackmail scandal, his ratings went up through the roof. Partially Google, partially everybody discussing it on Twitter, etc. It actually, that particular confession earned a bigger rating than any primetime program that evening. So the question is to what degree is it, you know, maybe providing a snippet causes one to come back to the original medium, or maybe it's vice versa as well. Maybe there needs to just be more of a symbiotic relationship, and all media needs to sort of merge into each other.
We don't know what the perfect model is. That's why people have to try a lot of different things. There's no question that if you think of your media as a place, I only want people to come to the Wall Street Journal site, that's insane. What you want to do is get on many different sites. You want to distribute, but you want to get paid for it if you can. Figure out some way to monetize. Could it be ads? Yes, it could be. Could it also be micropayments or some other? Yeah, or subscription? Of course it can be. And that's where you got to experiment and try. But you don't want to be where you're holding back and say, Google, you have to send them to my site, otherwise people can't do it. I think CBS was smart, what they did with YouTube, as you say. And I think that's, you want to be on lots of different platforms, but you want to try and figure out how to make money on it. Otherwise, you're dead.
Yeah.
And in the end, Larry Page said this to me. I mean, he's... Page was... When I interviewed him about this, he was going through a period of angst. He was basically saying to me, and it's reported in the book, I'm concerned about journalism. He was reading a book on journalism at the time. And he said, I'm concerned because search is based on good information. Good journalism is important to search. So I want to see if there's some way I can help, for instance, the New York Times, he said, without giving away the store. So, you know, and I describe in the book where he said, you know, we discussed, should we make a bid to buy the New York Times to preserve it? And they decided, no, they got to be Switzerland, neutral. And I think it was smart for them to make that decision. But they're saying, how do we figure out ways to pump more money? They'd like to do it through advertising, not payment. But eventually, what I see happening out there, and I wonder whether you agree with this, certainly I reported this in the book, that the people in the Valley are increasingly, I quote Mark Andreessen, I quote John Hennessy, the president of Stanford, who's on the Google board, as saying, we are moving towards, basically they're saying that the recession was a punch in the nose. We realized from that advertising is a weak reed to lean on alone. And because they were basically doing what broadcast television's done for years, one single source of revenue. So we have to get other sources of revenue. And we made a mistake, John Hennessy said to me in the early days of the internet, of thinking only of advertising and not of and thinking that information's free. We have to figure out some other payment system. Mark Andreessen said, I'm inches away from asking people for their credit card numbers for Ning. Okay, and already he charges people a premium price if they don't want to receive ads on Ning. So people are beginning to say, in the Valley, beginning to say, how do we begin to charge for things? Traditional media is obviously moving towards that. They're moving closer to each other, and that's a change, and one that might be hopeful for content creators in the long run.
Well, there's two things. One, that consideration that you just mentioned about the New York Times suggests not a cold engineer, but someone who is actually asking that second question. So,
I think they're getting an education.
Yeah,
I think that's absolutely. We're watching the education of Google, and I think my book that unspools in my book that these people who began as cold engineers and still are to a large extent about efficiencies, right? Suddenly realizing, oh my God, there are other forces in this world. There are not just publishers and television and Hollywood and studios, but also government, and not just the U.S. government, but governments all over the world, each of whom have different concerns. That, you know, if we want to make a deal with Verizon, which we have for Android, right, we have to be cognizant of Verizon's concern. And one of Verizon's concerns is, are you going to try and create hardware like us and compete against us directly? And I'm sure Google had to make assurances, which is easy for them to do. They don't want to be in the hardware business.
Yeah. Returning to the question of advertising as well, I'm curious if you think Google is responsible to a large degree for lowering the rates and therefore creating an advertising crisis where it's all going online because, I can get all this advertising for far more than, say, a $300,000 full-page ad in the New York Times, which, that's a lot of money. There was, what was it? It was a ski resort recently that actually decided, hey, we're not going to advertise in print at all. They cut their Condé Nast by 95%. They decided, you know what? People are going to really understand our resorts by seeing videos of people sloshing through the snow and the white just sifting up and people having fun. And you know, they're right. And so the question is whether Google bears some responsibility for these developments by, I suppose, undercutting print newspapers, or whether this just is just the maybe people want more for less. I don't know.
Google is empowering advertisers or consumers. I mean, I as a consumer, Google at one point, one of their officials who knows said 50% of our people see you click on the ads. I generally don't click on the ads on the right because they see the ads as part of search. It's information. It's not advertising. Now, if I as a user think of the advertising as information, that serves the interest of the advertiser, loves that. And the advertiser only pays when you click. And when you click, you can actually purchase something online, and therefore you have a direct relationship with the advertiser. So it's much more efficient for the advertiser. It's also much more efficient for the user. So Google is serving the interests of both users and advertisers. Inevitably, they're chasing away from traditional media the kind of advertising that is inefficient.
Yeah.
And that's a whole one of the points of that opening scene in my book, You're Fucking With the Magic. Yeah. I mean, Karmazan realizes he's making this visit, oh my God, these people are going to screw up my business.
Yeah.
That's creative destruction. That happens throughout history. Something new comes along and changes the old way of doing things. And usually it's more efficient. And in this case, it's more efficient for the consumer. It's not just more efficient for Google. And the consumer is being served. I mean, I have at my fingertips a library. I don't have to go to New York Public Library to do research. I have Google. You know, that's much more efficient for me. Is it harming traffic at the library? Probably. You know, is it harming traffic at museums that I could go on Google and actually see art? You know, of course.
But it is undercutting the sideways association. I mean, I discover numerous books and various other things by, oh, what's that right next to it? And
in a bookstore, you mean?
In a bookstore, in a library, in a record store, or even just like on somebody's shelf. That is the one kind of thing that Google cannot necessarily replicate.
No, it can't. And more than one truth can be true at the same time. And that's that great line from F. Scott Fitzgerald that made that point. The truth is, Google is doing wondrous things, but it's also, there are negatives involved in those wondrous things. Copyright, privacy, both of them might be negative, but also serendipity might be a problem. I mean, I had this great experience some years ago with Andy Grove when he was the head of Intel. I was interviewing before the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 95 in Dallas. And I said, Mr. Grove, the internet is coming online. You've got 1,000 editors in this room. In the future, as the internet grows and the online world grows, what's the value of these 1,000 editors in this room? And Grove, who loves being a provocateur, said, zero, we don't need them. I'm going to create my own newspaper, and I'll read what I want to read when I want to read. If I want to read, I'm interested in health, I'll have Health Corp pushed to me, news about that. And I'll get what I want. I'll create a Andy Grove newspaper. So all these editors sink lower in their seat and really depressed. 3 years later, I'm interviewing Grove again. And I quoted to him what he said to me. I said, Mr. Grove, do you still agree with what you told me 3 years ago? He said, I don't. I was totally wrong. I said, why? He said, because I realized the power of serendipity. And he said, I realized that now, in my Andy Grove newspaper, I wouldn't have had anything about what's going on in Sarajevo or Zambia or some other crisis spot that's in the news that I would not have anticipated that I needed to know about. And the surprise, the serendipitous surprise of reading a newspaper and discovering something you didn't expect to read about a book, about a movie, about a business, is a fabulous thing. And that's one of the things a newspaper or a bookstore does for you, the ability to browse. And be surprised.
Well, similarly, actually, I wanted to talk about 20% time really quick. Google allows engineers 20% time, but for non-engineer employees, they're more selective about it. The question is why Google has this particular strategy. Why do you believe they don't, or why do you have any quotes or any kind of findings to indicate why they would not give 20% time just to everybody? Why doesn't everybody have something to contribute to this great sort of machine here?
Because as well as Google treats all of its employees with the free food and the free laptops and the free bus service and the free, you know, medical care and dry cleaning and oil change, etc., the engineer is king at Google, and 50% of their employees are engineer, and they are pampered and treated differently. They are the content creators. They are, if you will, the Martin Scorsese's of Google's world. They create the apps, these cool apps that are so important to Google, and figure out how to improve search, which is so important to Google. And Google's bet is that by giving 20% free time to those engineers, you are liberating them from a sense that they are being micromanaged by managers. An engineer can say to his manager or her manager, you know, sorry, I can't do that now. I'm working on my 20% time. It's a day a week,
Yeah. You
know. And what they do with that time is basically try and work on things that they're passionate about. Why can't I do this cool thing? And then many of those things then are incorporated by Google. They go to Marissa Mayer on her office hours days, and she has several of them a week, and they present, and I sat in some of those meetings, they present some of the cool things they're working on the 20% time. She says, great, let's do this, and she's an engineer, and she's also smart and has a visual sense, and she says, do this, and come back to me. And at some point, they bring it to Larry and Sergey. And so it's, I think it's one of the ways they incubate entrepreneurship at Google.
Uh-huh. Because, and also,
and they know that. It's very deliberate.
I should point out also that Gmail and Google News emerged from 20% time
as
well.
So. Yep.
One last question. I wanted to ask you about the notion of the slogan, "Don't be evil." You write, "To simply say a corporation should be good ignores the range of choices a company is compelled to make in conducting its business." Sorry, really terrible handwriting. I just wanted to get the passage right.
I have the same.
So the question is whether a company like Google is just more inclined to be evil, or whether, in fact, by being aware of the fact that evil exists, it is perhaps more beneficial or more, I suppose, benign than other corporations, or are all corporations created equal?
I don't think they were equal. I think when "Don't be evil" was seized upon as their slogan, it one of the reasons it resonated within Google, it's an idealistic company led by its two engineering heads, the founders. And they see themselves as doing good. Build a user trust. Don't milk the advertisers. You know, don't try and lock people into your own portal. Send them to where they want to go. Give 1% of your profits every year to Google.org, their charitable arm. Let's do environmentally friendly things at Google. Let's create things that cool apps that also serve the interest. You know, what's going on, viruses around the world? Let's give early warning signs of that. Let's go Google Medical and let people share information. So they're doing these things that they see as advancing a social good. And they honestly believe that. But then they also live in the real world. So they want to be in the largest, as business people, they want to be in the largest consumer market in the world, China. And so Google Search goes to China. And they're going to, isn't it going to be great? We're going to democratize China, give everyone access to information. Then the Chinese government comes back at them and says, "Excuse me, guys, we don't want any searches on Tiananmen Square that show tanks or what happened there in 1989. We want to sanitize this stuff because," and so Google then is forced to make a decision. Do they stay in China? And to stay in China, they got to compromise with the Chinese government. Or do they insist on universal search and get thrown out of China? They make a decision to stay in China. They compromised, okay? Was that evil? No, I would not say that was evil. Some people might, I would not. But was it good? No, it wasn't good. I mean, they violated their principles to do that because they were business. So they were torn. They were being grown-ups in the real world.
But the slogan is "Don't be evil, not be good." So perhaps they lived up to the credo. Maybe Sergey and Larry calculated this all.
No, I don't think so, because if you went to their 2008 annual shareholder meeting, which I did, there was a resolution by a shareholder to basically change their policy in China and to insist on open search or get out. It was voted down by Larry and the board, who control the votes at Google. What did Sergey do? The young man who escaped with his family from the former Soviet Union, he abstained. And in his explanation of his abstention, he showed all the angst and confusion that he felt. And he knew he was compromising, but he did. But he didn't feel good about it.
Yeah. Would you say he's devoid, he's kind of outgrown his angst and confusion now that Google has effectively grown up? Or?
No, I think these are people who genuinely have social good in mind. They want to do good. I think they're idealistic young men. They are not coal businessmen. That's part of the distinction I was trying to make when I said coal engineers, not coal businessmen. They're not trying to harm people. They're not trying to harm the New York Times. But as Larry Page said to me, it's inevitable that I said, "Is it true? Do you think it's true that inevitably you will bump into traditional media companies some of the time?" He said, "Ken, not some of the time, all the time. It's just natural." But he didn't take any joy in saying that to me. Bill Gates, when I talked to him 10 years ago, took joy in saying something like that.
Yeah.
Larry Page didn't, and Sergey Brin doesn't, or Eric Schmidt doesn't. I think they are people who really want to do social good. But my job is not to sit there and applaud people I write about. It's to analyze the situation. In analyzing, I concluded they are really well-meaning folks, but sometimes they won't do good. And sometimes they will. There's a question: will they do good or not? And part of the job is to be a check and balance.
Well, on that circular note, Ken, thanks so much for taking the time out.
My pleasure.
Great. Thanks
for reading the book.
Sure.